Well, my name's Bud. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here. My sobriety date's October 5, 1985. And I don't take any credit for that. I'm here by God's grace. Left to my own devices, I self-destruct on a monotonous regularity. So I was introduced from Texas, and there's a reason. See, in Texas, we're taught early on, especially in AA, you never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So that's my story, and I'm claiming it, you know. All around the world, most fairy tales start once upon a time. And in Texas, they say, no shit, this ain't no lie, you know. But there's a good chance it is. So I asked Christy. She asked me if I'd come share, and I don't tell her no. She's been a friend for years and her mom. And so I asked her, I said, well, you want me to be serious? And so she said, no, not really. So I'll just tell you something about what got me here. But before I do, I'm going to take 30 seconds to just look around and say, wow, so many young people. I am so thrilled to be here. You know, this program is in such good hands. You know, I look at you young people and there's a lot of us got here years ago when the earth was flat. And, boy, it was different. It was different, you know. I mean, it took a half a dozen guys to make a set of teeth, you know, and just everything. I mean, you kids are so far ahead of where we were, you know. And the good thing about the program is that you're here and you're clean and sober. And you stay that way, and you don't have to go through all the misery, not only for yourself, but you don't put a lot of other people through a lot of misery. And that's a true blessing of this program. As I said, I'm here by God's grace and have been for a long time. I sobered up years and years ago, and I lost sight of what was important, and I drank after 10 and a half years, and I was out a little less than 4 years, and I wanted to be sober. But every time the pain would set in, I'd start drinking again. And finally, I was running out of options. And I went to a place called Starlight, and it was out by Austin, San Antonio. Really nice. Had landing strip in the back. Corporate jets came in. And when I went back a few months later, I had lost my job. And people didn't realize, but a couple days later, this admin nurse called me in, and she said, Bud, said, you have the only thing wrong with you that all these educated people can't fix. Said, you're broke. You need to be out here by noon. So, it's bad when you've been kicked out of a treatment center. I was pretty used to getting kicked out of countries and bars and things, but that's the first time I'd ever been kicked out of a treatment center. But it saved my life because I was only there because a boss wanted me to be sober. And as soon as he turned his back, I was going to go keep on doing what I'd been doing, which was self-destructing. So I went to Houston to a place called the Postal Club. And I'd been there before, and I went in and looked around and run into an old buddy of mine named Tom Needham. He had been a jailer in the Houston Police Department and really run a treatment center and a tough old guy. And I asked him if he'd be my sponsor, and he looked at me and he smiled. And years ago, they'd fill you with paraldehyde to stop you from going into DTs. And it was a cousin, like a formaldehyde, that they embalm you with. And it just reeks. It comes out of your pores. And so it's hard to tell anybody you've been on the Riviera when this paraldehyde's pouring out of you. But anyway, he looked at me and smiled. He said, I will, but you're going to need to do it my way because evidently your way's not working. And I was pretty teachable at the time. I had a lot of problems, all self-induced. You know, I just had problems, believe me. And I was way, way less than honest, put it that way, and I won't go into that. But I had legal problems, and I had the federal marshal was after me, plus I owed $150,000 in markers at the MGM. And they were after me. And I wasn't worried about the feds. I was used to dealing with them. But these guys from the MGM, they wanted their money. And so they explained to me that we never look at your ability to pay. We look at your willingness to pay because I'm sure we can make you willing. So I said, wow. So I paid them first, by the way. But when I, getting ready tonight. Christy told me, by the way, said, take a bath, you know, don't come up here like a slob. So anytime normally when I put a suit on, I head down to the federal building to go to court. So this is a pleasant surprise. My car immediately just headed downtown, and I thought, wow, I don't have to go there. I can come here tonight and be with my friends. We had dinner, a bunch of us, Betty and I got to talking, and about remember some of the old guys, and you got really miss meeting some of these people. They were colorful. Years and years ago when the earth was flat, a lot of these old guys, they drank 20, 30 years or whatever, and they had really had some colorful tales. And my sponsor before he passed away was a man named Charlie Frank, and every Sunday he and Betty would go to a noon meeting. But when he first came in, I was his sponsor in the early 70s, and I'm sure glad I treated him nice, because when I came back, he was my sponsor. So be careful who you're mean to, you know. Okay. All right. If you can't hear me, you're not missing anything. When I came back, Charlie was my sponsor, and he was up until he died. And he died with 30 years, and just a great guy. And on the way over here from the restaurant, my eyes were tearing up because I miss him. And he helped a lot of people. And there's a lot of people that were basically standing on these people's shoulders, because, I mean, they're here in spirit. But I've been told, you know, when these people, if they live in your heart, they're never dead. So I'm going to claim that. I sort of have a firsthand knowledge of living life a day at a time. I have a stage 4 cancer, and I've been in the medical system last 3-4 years, and I've had a bunch of surgeries and 56 radiation treatments, and every once in a while I go in for a tune-up, and they cut on me and things. So I really have a real firsthand knowledge of living a day at a time. And radiation, you don't lose your hair, that's chemo. And so people say, well, you know, it couldn't be true coming from me because you hadn't lost your hair. But that's chemo, not radiation. Radiation's pretty site-specific. I had a young lady in my life 2 or 3 years ago, and she didn't think I was going to Huntsman to have radiation because I wasn't real sick till the last part of it. And so she went to... I got treatment every afternoon at 3:00. So she went with me one day, and she went inside, and she asked the nurse, said, is this slug having radiation every day? And she said, every day, 3:00. So she thought I was seeing some chick there or something, you know. It's $6,000 a day. I wish I was too, you know. I could have took her to Hawaii, you know. But anyway, it was she was a little insecure. And, I was a good chameleon. I'd throw up maybe in the parking lot or whatever and wash my face. Then I'd go in the house and try to smile like I was okay. But I didn't really want anybody. Basically, I didn't want anybody to feel bad for me, because as Betty and I were talking, you know, I've been on borrowed time half my life. I joined the Marine Corps at 17 because I didn't like people telling me what to do. Now that's not, that was a rude awakening. I had a couple of my buddies and I, we grew up in a poor neighborhood in Houston, by the way, and real dysfunctional family. I tried to get my family on Jerry Springer one time and he wouldn't take them. Now that tells you how bad it is. But I developed this liking for these Corvettes, and you know, when you're a kid in high school, you don't have a lot of spendable money, so the best way to get them was steal them, you know, and I wasn't beyond that anyway. And my dad had this plumbing shop, and so he was doing a job in California, so we had his shop to cut these cars up. So we had boosted about 15, and there was a set years ago, there was a set what they call blanks, and there was a set of keys, and they would drive any GM car. So we weren't even busting the locks, we were getting in these new cars and taking them to my dad's shop and stripping them. And we weren't bright enough to sell the parts. We gave them to all our friends in the auto shop. So everybody in our auto shop had Corvette engines, wheel seats, all of that. And then we'd take them out in the woods and we'd burn them, burn the bodies for fingerprints because we're smart. So anyway, by the way, they look like black cotton candy, you know, when you burn them. And so we had run out of money because we weren't selling these parts, so we decided to we were going to rob the. Now, you're in a poor neighborhood if the wealthiest person in your neighborhood is the milkman, but it was. And so we were going to rob this milkman, and we thought, well, that's not real smart. You know, that's big time. So we just did a burglary. We broke into this Borden Milk Company. And in the south and around the drilling areas is what it's called a rig-up truck or a gin truck. It's got this big A-frame in the back, and I know Craig knows what they are. So we leaned it over and backed it through this big glass door in the front and run in and wrapped about three loops of this cable around this big safe, stood about that high, and kicked it in gear and drove off. Well, the problem, it didn't line up with the door. It took the whole front of this glass door out, or glass wall. And the paper the next day, it said somebody had bombed this Borden Milk Company. Well, it wasn't. We took it down the street and dropped it in one of my dad's plumbing trucks with signs on the truck. That's how smart we were. And took it back to his shop and opened the safe up. Now, hopefully you'll never do it, but if you do, the bottom of the safe is the weakest part if you're going to break in one. Not the door, not the top, not the sides, the bottom. So we laid this safe over and we got into it and got caught naturally not too long after that. So I'm a senior in high school, and I was headed to reform school, and this recruiter shows up at my house. Now, I didn't know how he found me till later in life, but anyway, the judges, and in those days, all the punk kids, they swept the streets every once in a while, put them in the military. And this recruiter shows up at my house and said, how would you like to go in the Marine Corps? And I said, as opposed to what? He said, well, his report is opposed to reform school. And I said, well, put me down. So I didn't turn 18 until the 22nd of June, and the 2nd of June I was already in the service. So, but that was just a start, because I'd already had I'd already experimented with a lot of alcohol and, occasionally drugs too. The pot grew, we called it dirt weed. It grew everywhere in the ditches. And it was real low strength. I mean, you had to smoke 2 acres to get a buzz, you know. But it was everywhere. And in Houston is a huge Hispanic town. And so there was always any kind of drug you wanted. But basically, we were drinkers. And booze was cheap. And it wasn't legal when you were 17, but it was okay. And I spent 5 years and 8 months, 26 days, but who's counting, in the Marine Corps. And I was wounded 3 times. Ended up back in Balboa Naval Hospital in San Diego. And by that time, I had a bad alcohol problem and a bad drug problem. And I know her name, but I'll call her plaintiff number one. It was my first wife. She came and she was visiting a kid that was next to me, and he was a next-door neighbor. And I spied her, and wow, she was a model from Marshall Fields in Chicago, really attractive. And so I said something I'm sure was inappropriate, and I said it again, and she said, well, do you want to even know my name? I said, well, it's not necessary, but anyway. So this old nurse said, oh, don't pay any attention to him. He's probably still on. Well, I might have been, but anyway, her neighbor was transferred up to Oakland. He was a paraplegic by that time, and it was getting close to holidays, so she said, would you want me to come back and visit you? I said, well, absolutely. So she took me home to for Christmas, and we ended up having 3 children, married 8.5 years, and she thought that my drinking and my drugs had something to do with where I'd been. But it wasn't really true. I'd gotten this military with bad habits already, and it just exacerbated it because I was the youngest person in this one outfit, and I wanted to catch up. I wanted to fit. And drugs and alcohol took me farther and faster than I ever wanted to go. And I caught up with these older guys that were 20, 21, older, you know. And when I got out before I was wounded, I was 18, almost 24, and they used to call me Pops. Right. And I picture 24 being one of the oldest guys in there. But today it's almost funny, but had some real problems. And they were all self-induced, too. So this lady and I married. We had these 3 children. And she gave me a lot of slack because she thought it was from my military thing, but it wasn't. I was predisposed to be an alcoholic and a druggie both just from my childhood, and I loved it, and I loved the escape, and so I was off and running, went to school on the GI Bill, and this lady was my age, but all the time I was in the service, she had been in college, and so she made good money, and so she allowed me to go to school. I went to school on the GI Bill, and I got out and went to work for a drilling company, and I'm working platforms offshore. Betty's familiar with them. Gulfport, Mississippi, Morgan City, Louisiana, New Orleans, Lake Pontchartrain, and the platforms out in the Gulf of Mexico. And we were making good money. I mean, today it wouldn't be, but every 100 hours I'm making $6,000-$8,000 in cash. Never got home with a penny because we'd go to the bars. And I'd go there for one drink. And a couple days later, I'm sleeping in the back seat of my car, probably threw up, like my head like that. And if you've ever been in New Orleans in the summer when the sun comes up, it's already 100. And the humidity's about 95. And I'm telling myself, wow, why didn't I just go get a room and pay for it? You know, I wouldn't be sleeping. I'd be stone broke, you know. And I'd say, well, it's going to be different next time. Well, I'm going to tell you, folks, it was never different. It was never, because I thought it was somebody else's fault. But, you know, all my problems were right here all the time. And I had a terrible addiction problem and didn't want to do anything about it. I'm a gambler also, and I thought I was just having a little run of bad luck. And it persisted for a long time. And this lady, I came home one day, and she said, by the way, you don't live here anymore. So I said, well, how about my clothes? She said, I gave them to Goodwill. And so I said, well, how about my jewelry box? I had a Rolex watch that a girlfriend had gave me, and it had an inscription on the back. And I said, well, I had a couple really expensive watches. And she said, yeah, that's what that driver said. Those are real nice watches. So I went to the pawn shop and bought my watch back, because it had an inscription on it. I was able to identify it. And I lied to this pawn shop owner. I told him it was stolen, and I wouldn't call the police if he had let me buy it back. And he was more than happy to. So, you know, it's not really good conduct if you have to go to a pawn shop to buy your stuff back. Something may be wrong in your life, you know, and just maybe vaguely. But that put me, I was off and running. And, boy, I tell you what, I've worked all over the world, been around the world 1.5 times, and I was always running from me. And every time I would unload off one of those 747s, you know, I'm thinking it's going to be different, but it never was different, because all my problems had always had puppies along the way. And within a day or two, they'd all got together, you know, and I'm off and running the same thing. And I worked for a drilling company out of Texas called Dresser Industries, and it was a Fortune 100 company. In our heyday, we had 54,000 people scattered around the world, and they really, really treated me right, because I'd troubleshoot for them. Didn't want to go home because I was always in trouble, so I'd go anywhere they wanted me to go, and they were paying me just bank money, but I wasn't a good steward. And the Bible talks about, too, you can be a steward over a few things, you never have many things, and boy, that was me. You know, I could make 7 figures and not pay my taxes, not once, but years, because, you know, they didn't print money as fast as I could spend it. But I'm telling you this not because I'm unique, but I belong here. And until I was willing to do something about it, it was never going to be any different, never. And my friend Todd, Betty and I were talking about him tonight, and he had 5 years behind bars in prison. And he talks about the dark night of the soul. And excuse me, that's so true, because one night I woke up and I said, you know, it'll never, ever be any different. You'll affect other people, because, you know, we alcoholics and / druggies, we're like, remember that old movie Sanford and Son, where this junk dealer driving down the street and the shit just falling off and he looks pretty good? That's alcoholic for you, you know. You know, you have this facade and you look okay. It's going to get better, ladies. It's not really. But, you know, I my drinking and drug, it affected a lot of people in my life. And but I wasn't ready to quit. But society, you know, working the steps was easy, especially the first half of the first step, because it was evident by society standards my life was unmanageable. And the second step, when it says restore me to sanity, I always wanted to rewrite that one because I didn't start off sane. How are you going to Webster's version of restore is to put you back to normal, put you back to new. Well, I wasn't normal when I was new. I always wanted it to say made me sane, you know. And but they never asked me if I wanted to rewrite it, so I just lived with it. But I always said to myself, you know, it would let me be sane. And I'm probably not today, but I'm probably the closest that I've ever been. And because I was taught by people, and boy, I tell you what, they weren't real kind. A lot of these old people, like Dave Ace and some of them, they didn't care about your feelings. They didn't give a shit about your feelings. Now, they won't tell you the truth, you know. And sometimes the truth was pretty brutal, you know. And I was a sensitive person, I thought. And, you know, and they would explain to you, you know. It was comical because they were just 30-year drunks. And a lot of them had traveled. They had done all of these things. But to go to a meeting, especially a BS session afterwards, I mean, it was like comedy club. And I sobered up in Houston the second time after I got kicked out of the Starlight at a place called the Postal Club. And all of these guys, there was a pecking order, like, and these, we'd meet real early in the morning in this table because most of them didn't have JOBs. And I'm borrowing $6,000 to $8,000 every month from my mother because I'm mowing her lawn to pay my attorney. And when I left town, several of my buddies wanted to apply for that lawn mowing job, you know. But by that time, I'd pretty well broke her. But I had an opportunity to go back in the drilling business up in South Dakota. A friend of mine called me, and he said, Bud, said, I want you to have this contract. It was a 2-year contract. And he knew I was broke as the Ten Commandments. I didn't have any money. But he said, the Norwest Bank in Minneapolis has these three drilling rigs, and we were going to buy them, but I'd rather you do it. And so I had a federal license to drill anywhere in the lower 48. So I said, well, like, so he said, I'll give you a PO up front. You go up there and negotiate with these people for these rigs. And he gave me the prices and the whole bit. So I was pretty armed when I went up. And this banker on the 10th floor, like of Minneapolis, of Norwest Bank. And I didn't have anything to lose, but I had a briefcase and I had a couple other things in my hand. And it's big old tall, about a 12-foot door. And I opened it, and I opened the door, and I took my foot, and I pushed it. Well, it didn't have a door closed on it. It went, BAM! And this man looked up, and I walked in. I said, shit, I don't have anything to lose now. So I walked in, and then he said, what can I do for you? I said, I'm here to buy those three drilling rigs you have. And they had repoed them out of Canada, and they weren't not in too good a shape. So I said, well, what do you want for them? And he said, well, $750,000 a piece. So it's 2.25. So he said, well, what are you willing to pay? I said, well, I'll pay you $1.5 million for the three. And I said, because I know they're wrote off, so it's going to go right to profit. So he said, okay. He said, when are you going to do this? I said, well, I'm going to pay you over 12 months. And he knew I had a PO from Homestake, and so he knew. And I said, they'll pay you instead of me. So he knew he'd get his money. So I'm on a run. He said, okay. So I said, and by the way, he said, I need another $100,000 to operate on the first month. And so he wasn't crazy about that, but he agreed to it because I was his best bet. So he, on the way out of the door, and I said, and by the way, I need you to move them to the Black Hills in South Dakota too for me, you know. And so he said, but I really hope this comes out okay. But it did. I paid them off. But it was comical now, but when you don't have anything to lose, you get pretty creative, you know. And I needed another start. I needed to go back in business. And I got to pick my own crew. And it was funny because I picked people just like me. I had two crews of seven. I had a buddy of mine from South Africa named Gary Magnuson, kid from Australia. They were just like me. They were drunk. And we lived at a Best Western hotel in Deadwood, South Dakota. and we had a slush fund. The band had owned it. His name was Kermit Still, and we would keep several $1,000 that he would have, and when we would get low, we'd replenish it because my crew was getting locked up every weekend for drunk and disorderly. And so, but I needed him, so Kermit would go bail him out. And when I'd be there, he'd say, "You're getting low," because I'd take it out of their check because they're making a grand a day. So they were good for it, but we just had to get them out of jail because I needed them. So we'd replenish this slush fund. And about that time, I decided that, you know, I needed to be sober again. And so I started trying to be sober. And every time I'd get a little time, that pain had set in. And the last time I thought I was going to have to die to get sober. But I teamed up with some people, and I started doing it their way. And they started taking me through the book and said, "This is what you do." Not suggested, "This is what you do." And I was pretty pliable. I started taking instruction, first time in a long time. And it was the beginning of the beginning of the beginning. And that doesn't mean life can't get tough, but it's always been worth whatever I had to do to stay sober. I had a friend that said something the other day. Her name is Paige, and a lot of you know her. And she said something that was so astute. And she said, "If you're new, you need to stay around till you have something to lose." And I thought that was good. Molly heard her. Wasn't that good? And I stole that. I told her as soon as I got out of town, I'm going to use it. But I didn't even wait that long. But, you know, if you have 3 days and you're sleeping in the parking lot, you in your mind and your heart, you don't have anything to lose. You know, if you go out, hopefully, I mean, you've got a good chance of losing your life because you may not make it back. But like Paige said to us, she said, "I've got a husband I love, a baby, a home, all of these things. I'm not willing to give that up to alcohol or drugs anymore." So she's vested. She has a vested interest in staying clean and sober. And I think that's a good, lesson for all of us, because I have a good life, and I'm not willing to give it up to drugs and alcohol. You know, if I don't know how much longer I have, but when I do, I want to die sober. I want to die sober. And because that's important to me. And it wasn't always, but today it is. And it's, you know, this program's about so much more than drugs and alcohol. Those are only symptoms. What it's really about, it's about learning to live sober. I sobered up many times. You know, I'd made jails in places you couldn't find on a map, you know, but usually because of alcohol and drugs. But today, I'm willing to do whatever it takes, and I wasn't always that way. When I made jail once in Tijuana, Mexico, and that was one of my better jails because I was in the service, and we got locked up for being drunk and disorderly and fighting, and 2 or 3 days later, this jailer comes in and said, "You guys want to buy some beer?" And we said, "Of course," you know. So here we're locked up in jail, and we're drinking beer. And we had got arrested Saturday night, and the provost marshal from the military comes every other Saturday morning and bails out all the military kids. And so we got locked up that night. So that means all that week, all the next week, we have to still be in jail. And so a couple days later, he come in and said, "You guys want to buy some pot?" We said, "Well, of course." I mean, it was dirt weed, but you can't be real selective if you're in jail. So when this provost marshal come 2 weeks later to bail us out, my buddies and I, we were drunker than when we got arrested. And this guy could never figure out I guess he thought we were really drunk if 2 weeks later we're still drunk. But we had been drinking in jail. But I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. I've made jails in Alaska, made jail in downtown Saigon. It was called LBJ, and that wasn't Lyndon Baines Johnson. It was called Long Bend Jail. It was a military brig, and they're not real pleasant places. They want to make them unpleasant so you don't come back. Got locked up in Hawaii one time. We were in downtown Honolulu, but we had what they call Cinderella Liberty, and that means you have to be back at midnight, you know, like the send of the shoe. And naturally, we didn't because we're pretty tanked up, my buddy and I. And We got back to the dock the next morning. We looked out, and we're on a carrier, the Kitty Hawk, and it's 1,200 foot long. It's huge. And we looked out, and there's nothing on the horizon, just water. And my buddy, he's really articulate. He said, "Bud," said, "either that son of a bitch is sunk or we're in a lot of trouble." And I said, "Let's hope it's on the bottom of the bay." So we we turned into the front gate, and we're out there. We're E5s and had a hash mark. Then we've been in years. We're picking up cigarette butts. And here comes this old E9 off the Hawk, and he seen us and wasn't real happy. He said, "What are you shitbirds doing here?" And we said, "We got a little problem, Top. Get us out of here." So he went to the guards and said, "I'll take these two dummies." He didn't say dummies. He said, "I'll take these two people off your hands." So we went back to the, got back, we had a helicopter, and so we went back to the carrier and went before the old man, and he gave us a 2 weeks restriction. We couldn't go anywhere. Now, we're in the South China Sea, 6,000 miles from anywhere, like we're going to go somewhere. So, but military pretty well, they took care of their own if you were one of them. And I used to think that was so neat, but it really wasn't, because it enabled us, and it let dysfunctional, undisciplined people go longer than they should. Today, I get the pleasure of seeing my friends, my family do well, and that's been the greatest joy of being sober for a while. There's kids here that I know. Some of them I know your parents, and that's, it just makes my heart just absolutely happy. I see these young moms here, Sarah, Melissa, with these babies, and there's others too. And these children will never, ever have to know and go through what we put our parents through, because they're going to have a different life. And that's so, so neat. And that's important. You know, being accountable for yourself, that's important. The what poet is it? Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, says, you know, character is who you are when nobody's looking. And I think that's so important, because my word was never good. Never, ever, ever. And it's only been the last few years I've tried to develop some character. And when you're not looking, I try to do the right thing. And that's different for me, because I had to learn that. I'll share this and I'll sit down. We're going to be running out of time. I was in Houston almost 6 years ago. And if you've never been there, like New Orleans, it can rain 2-3 inches in a water. I mean, the rain in an hour, the raindrops are the size of 50 cent pieces. And I'm going into this cafeteria, because I've been here a while, and eating barbecue and just fatty food. So I'm going in this steam table to have something healthy. And there was this car pulls up, and this young college kid happened to be African-American. And he had his great-grandmother in the car. And I helped him, because he couldn't stay where he was, so I helped her get inside. And they were celebrating her 100th birthday, and her hair was just white as snow. And I got her in, got her sitting in, her great-grandson parked the car. And then I went in and ordered. And so he came over and said, "Would you join us for lunch?" And I was thrilled to. And so she told me about being a teacher growing up in the South. And Houston's a very wealthy city. And they used to say separate but equal, but that was wrong. I mean, it was separate but separate, because the Caucasian schools got all the money and the black schools got what was left over. And her name was Ms. Elsie. And she was telling me that they would get these books and half the pages would be missing. And they would buy one book new, and then they would type out all the pages and put them in. And very creative. And so she, when she told me she was a teacher, I said, "Well, my mom was a teacher. She passed at 94. And she said, "Well, what was her name?" And I told her, and she said, "I knew Miss Carrie. We used to go to these teachers' things together." Excuse me. So she asked me, just out of the clear, she said, "Well, are you honest?" And I thought, wow. She said, "Your mom would want you to be honest." And I said, "Most days." And she said, "Well, what days are you not honest?" I said, "Well, the ones ending in Y." So she said, "Well, you need to make that right, you know." And so, excuse me, a couple weeks ago, she passed away. And I got a chance to go to, they were having their 100th birthday, and they were having this huge thing at her church, and I got to be there and got to meet, and she had touched people's lives like crazy, but I was really touched that she said, I was scheduled to go to your mom's funeral, and I didn't get sick, but my daughter did. It was in her 80s. It was going to take her, see? So, but she didn't know my mom, and she said, I told her, you know, that I was going to work on that. And I'd always got in trouble for insider trading, money laundering. I never took a pistol, you know, and robbed anybody. I did it with a gold cross pin because you could get a lot more money. And if you rob somebody, you're a crook. But if you just take their money away, you're an unsuccessful businessman. So, but really, you're a crook. So she made me look at some things. And when she passed away a couple of weeks ago, every time I think of her, I'm still sad because I wanted more time with her. You know, I wanted her counsel. But right after that, I started making some changes in my life, and they hadn't always been easy because the Bible talks about taking the wide road or the narrow road, and I always chose the wide road. But there's a real price to pay when you do that, because sooner or later, if you stay here and you stay sober, you have to clean it up. And wow, of course, I'm smarter than most people, so it dawned on me after 20-something years. But if you don't create all these problems, you don't have to clean them up later. So isn't that smart? I mean, most people at 6 months already know that. But, you know, but I am a slow learner. So today, I'm doing better. I'm not totally honest, but I'm working on it, and 99% of the time I am, but not for society even. It's basically because even old sociopaths change sooner or later. I just don't want to clean it up, and I want to stay and see my friends. I want to see you do well. I want to see, because you're the true joys in my life, and I've been so blessed to be here, and watch all these young people. My volunteer job is at the VA, and I get to see these people, and they're in a twilight of their life. And I come here, and you're at the beginning of your life. And I come here and draw strength from you. I can sit there and not say a thing and just look around and just be as happy as I can be. And I was thrilled when Chrissy asked me a couple days ago to come here and share. And I was telling my sponsor, and he said, well, before you get to Big Head, what you need to ask is how many people she asked in front of you. So I didn't even ask her that because I didn't care. But I'm just glad I'm here. It was great. Hi, sweetie. And, hey, I knew you before you were famous too, Becky. But Becky's dad was a friend of mine. And so, and I'm thrilled to see her. I knew that she was on the way before she did. But, you know, I love you all. I've been around here long enough that I can tell men and women I love them without a need to go to R.C. Willie and buy furniture or anything. And, you know, and I do. I truly love you because you're walking this thing just like me. You don't need me here. The program will be great without me, but I sure need you. Thank you.